has various stratagems, and that nation will be successful which is not deceived. On the importance of acquiring modern sciences and technologies for Basijis, Ayatollah Khamenei says, Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the unknown scientific vistas, technological vistas, and innovative vistas. In other words, he believes that Basij should be equipped with two tools of knowledge and faith in order to be helpful in diverse spheres of services to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Ummah. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, I always envy of the sincerity and purity of Basijis and appeal to God to resurrect me with Basijis, as in this world I am honored to be a Basiji.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Another Palestinian prisoner has died in one of the Israeli jails as a result of medical negligence. Sami Amour, 39 years old, died in custody at the Israeli Soroka Hospital in Bir al-Sabah in Al-Naqab. Amour from Deir al-Balah City in the Gaza Strip was imprisoned since 2008, and he suffered from congenital heart problems, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Amour was transferred several days ago from Nafha prison to Asqalam. He was then transferred to Soroka Hospital after his health deteriorated. The Prisoners' Society held Israel responsible for Amour's death because of the deliberate medical negligence and inappropriate detention conditions.
Medical treatment is among the basic rights of each man according to all international laws. Many Palestinian prisoners have died because of medical negligence. Omar was suffering from serious deteriorated health conditions. The Israeli prison authorities knew that he was in pain and had heart problems, but they never provided him with even medical examinations. It was a slow killing policy that Israel used against Omar and is now using against other prisoners as well.
227 Palestinian prisoners have died in Israeli jails and detention centers since 1967. Hundreds of other prisoners have lost their lives shortly after their release. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the main reason for the deaths of majority of those prisoners was lack of medical care.
Umur is the latest victim of Israel's deliberate medical negligence. This is one of the most prominent systematic policies that have killed many prisoners in Israeli jails. Since 1967, 227 prisoners have died behind bars. Israel continues its policies and crimes amid the international silence.
According to a statement by the Prisoners' Society, some 5,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Some 550 of the detainees suffer from very difficult health conditions due to chronic diseases and inhumane Israeli policy concerning their treatment. The death of Sami Amour sheds light on the suffering of hundreds of sick prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners' organizations call for an immediate international intervention to save the lives of these prisoners. They also warn that Israeli jails might turn into graves for severely ill detainees, as Israel insists on keeping them behind bars without offering appropriate medical care. Muna Khandil, occupied Ramallah.
Emma
Women's Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and Children has held an event in the capital Sana'a to mark the International Day for Children's Rights. The local body released a report highlighting the tragic situation of Yemeni children amid the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade for the course from March 2015 to November 2021.
For 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition, with the support of the United States, has been carrying out airstrikes and killing Yemeni children. This is a flagrant violation of international law that guarantees the protection of children during conflicts and wars. The Saudi-led coalition seeks to destroy the future of the Yemeni people by targeting educational facilities and depriving the children of their basic rights. These children are the basic foundation for building a new Yemen when the war ends.
The report says 300 Yemeni children die every day due to the lack of health services. The number of children suffering from cancerous tumors has also reached 71,000 as a result of the Saudi-led coalition's use of internationally prohibited weapons in bombing residential areas.
There is injustice and grave violation of rights against the Yemeni children. On top of them, it is the right to live. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has targeted schools and disrupted the educational process. The right to access healthcare also does not exist amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport and the lack of necessary medicines. When we talk about children's rights in Yemen, we feel pain, and only those who experienced it will feel this pain. The children of Yemen celebrate International Day for Children's Rights because it gives them hope despite their stolen rights.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children, and displaced millions more.
Yemenis say the atrocities of Saudi Arabia and the suffering of the Yemeni children are the results of the years-long war and siege imposed on the country. They believe that the UN's removal of Riyadh from the list of parties responsible for grave violations against children last year has emboldened the kingdom to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
July 14, 2015. After years of negotiations, Iran signed a deal with the US, the UK, France, Germany, China, and Russia, which put caps on Tehran's nuclear program in return for sanctions removal. The agreement was dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. At first, it seemed like there was a new era of cooperation between Iran and the West, but that optimism was soon shattered by Washington. In 2016, Donald Trump won the race to become the President of the United States. During his tenure, he adopted an increasingly hostile attitude toward Tehran. This enmity reached a peak in 2018 when Trump unilaterally pulled his country out of the Iran nuclear deal, violating an international accord and a Security Council resolution that endorsed it. He then reinstated previous sanctions on Tehran and even imposed new ones. At the same time, he threatened other parties to the deal, including its allies, with sanctions if they refused to comply with Washington's anti-Iran measures. Despite the US withdrawal, Tehran declared that it would continue respecting its commitments under the agreement. That is, if the remaining parties, referred to as the P4 plus 1 group, guaranteed Iran's benefits as was promised under the JCPOA. Iran showed ample patience for the other sides to honor their end of the bargain. In fact, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in its 16 reports, confirmed Tehran's full compliance with the JCPOA until 2019. It was in May that year, and a whole year after the US withdrawal, that the country started scaling back its commitments when Britain, France, and Germany failed to keep their end of the deal. Iran's remedial measures were in line with mechanisms foreseen in the text of the JCPOA, particularly Articles 36 and 37. The country, on numerous occasions, said it would reverse those measures if the other parties respected their commitments. But after more than 3 years following Washington's unilateral pullout, Iran could not see any change on the part of the Western signatories. Ironically, the new US administration under President Joe Biden persisted with its predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Between April and June this year, Tehran held talks with the P4 plus 1 group with the aim of removing the sanctions that had been illegally imposed on it. But no breakthrough was reached. Now, a new round of talks is scheduled to start on the 29th of November. Ahead of the negotiations, Iranian officials have declared that the talks must focus on the full removal of sanctions in a verifiable manner. They have also made it clear that they will not renegotiate the country's nuclear program.
As I said, these negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions imposed by Americans through their violation of the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. We concluded nuclear negotiations in 2015, which resulted in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
Moreover, Tehran has emphasized that it will only engage in talks that lead to practical results.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
The talks between Iran and the P4+1 group will start on November 29th in Vienna, and Tehran will certainly take the other side's promises with a grain of salt, considering the West's record of violating its own commitments.
Thousands of people leaving their home countries in pursuit of a better life are now trapped in appalling conditions and fighting for survival at Belarus's western border with Poland. Their dream was to enter the EU, but now they are stuck behind barbed wires battling freezing weather and hunger. Almost a dozen of them have already died, and fears are growing for the safety of others.
It's like so many of them doesn't have food, water, they have small kids, and they're freezing, and the weather is pretty cold. That's all I have to say.
It's no good, no water, no food, no time, no life.
Mostly from Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, migrants have been stranded in a wooded area for weeks. Fed up with the dire living conditions, a group of them tried to cross into Poland on Tuesday. But Polish forces guarding the fortified border crossing used tear gas and water cannon to push them back.
You don't follow the orders.
That triggered some to throw stones at the border guards. The incident drawing this reaction from Moscow.
The behavior of the Polish side is completely unacceptable. I think the water cannons and tear gas and shots over the migrants' heads toward Belarus state, all of it reflects a desire to hide their own actions. And they cannot but understand that they violate all thinkable norms of the international humanitarian law and other international law norms.
The EU is accusing Belarus of engineering an unprecedented wave of migrants at Poland's border in revenge for the sanctions it's suffering from the bloc. Belarus, however, denies the allegations, accusing the EU of turning its back on the migrants and trying to shift the blame on Minsk to justify its new sanctions. Russia is backing Belarus in this dispute, with the Kremlin questioning the EU's double standards over the migrant crisis, warning that such approaches put the bloc in a bad position. The EU is now looking to widen the sanctions on Belarus. Reacting to the news of the new sanctions, President Alexander Lukashenko said Belarus does not want confrontation with bloc over the migrant crisis. Lukashenko even initiated a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday to discuss his proposal to end the crisis. Considering Belarus's earlier threat to shut down Russian gas supplies to Europe via pipelines that run through its territory, its latest reaction to the EU's fresh sanctions could be interpreted as a desire for de-escalation.
The Yellow Vests have marked their third anniversary, going from a ragtag group of gas tax protesters into a political force which has overturned decades of Western political norms. The defining image of the Emmanuel Macron era is undoubtedly the graffiti on the Arc de Triomphe, which read, "The Yellow Vests will triumph." That shocked the world, and then so did the once-in-a-century political repression which gutted France's claim of being a leader in free speech and political freedom. The numbers were staggering. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 political prisoners, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. The Yellow Vests continue to redefine what citizen democracy is in the digital era by refusing to collude with the traditional hierarchies found in Western liberal democracies.
What we have done is provide a sort of national therapy. We made everybody, from politicians to unions to our institutions, fully aware of what a catastrophic situation France is in for the average person. 3 years ago, we took to the streets to demand economic justice, democratic justice, and ecological justice, and our movement has just begun.
Many ask what happened to the Yellow Vests, and the primary answer is that the massive state-sponsored violence and judicial intimidation, like the so-called anti-Yellow Vest law, scared the average person away from protesting. From June 2019 onwards, there seemed to be a blackout in French media on the Yellow Vests, as well as a massive censorship campaign on social media. After a year and a half pause due to the coronavirus, the Yellow Vests have marched every Saturday for over a month. They are expected to play a major role in France's presidential election in April.
The Yellow Vests have proven themselves to be a new and entirely different type of political force, one which insists on inserting themselves into the political discourse, no matter how much some may try to ignore, silence, or repress. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Saint-Pierre has always been one of the busiest hospitals in Brussels, but now it is busier than ever. In the 24 hours up to Wednesday, more than 12,000 new cases of coronavirus were recorded in Belgium and 41 deaths. Even at the doors of Saint-Pierre, it's easy to find people who are vaccine hesitant.
I feel concerned for my part, but I know people from my age feel concerned but aren't really good with the idea of getting vaccinated.
I don't need the vaccine because it's 2 years there is the coronavirus, but I'm good. I'm very good. I'm not sick. And my family is not sick.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging across the EU. In Italy, workers cannot physically attend their jobs without a COVID pass. Experts suggest the country is doing better than neighbours because more children there have received the jab. In Austria, the unvaccinated have effectively been put into lockdown. Most venues in the Netherlands must close by 8 p.m. Hospitals in Ireland, Czech Republic, Bulgaria and Romania are struggling to cope.
So the message remains clear. Get vaccinated. Maintain masks and social distance. Vaccination is necessary in our fight against this virus.
A fifth wave of the virus is hitting France, Germany and Belgium. Health experts say there is still a lot about the crisis that is not understood. For example, it is not known why the vaccines do not work on 10% of people who take them. It is not clearly known for how long the vaccines remain effective. What is known, however, is that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to end up in hospital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid Al-Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fasfus is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says Al-Fasfus could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelay Medical Center, where he is being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fasfus or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fasfus won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Kaid Al-Fasfus, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follows the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid al-Fasfus and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, al-Fasfus' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Political factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aids are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Muslims' duty towards the all-inclusiveness of Islam, promoting Islam's viewpoint.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
God tells the Holy Prophet, "Then fight in Allah's cause. You are held responsible only for yourself, and rouse the believers." The Holy Quran, Surah 4, verse 84. This means that all these areas of life, ranging from standing to prayer by night, supplicating and shedding tears, to fighting and showing one's presence in the battlefield, are areas where religion is active, and the Holy Prophet's life confirms this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Regarding financial rules, the Quran says, "But give them preference over themselves, even though poverty was their own lot." The Holy Quran, Surah 59, verse 9. This is a personal matter. Elsewhere it says, "In order that it may not merely circulate between the wealthy among you." The Holy Quran, Surah 59, verse 7. This is about the correct distribution of wealth, which is a matter totally related to society. Elsewhere it says, "That men may stand forth in justice." The Holy Quran, Surah 57, verse 25. The prophets and the favorites of God have come to establish justice. One verse says, "To those weak of understanding, make not over your property, which Allah has made a means of support for you." The Holy Quran, Surah 4, verse 5. In another verse, God says, "Of their goods, take alms, so that you might purify and sanctify them." The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 103. All aspects of financial matters are mentioned in the form of general principles and general guidelines. Of course, there should be plans for implementing these rules, but these are the general rules and guidelines that are mentioned. In other words, Islam has spoken about all these matters. We'll be right back.
that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran condemns the latest U.S. sanctions targeting several Iranian nationals and one entity, saying the measures are illegitimate and baseless. The United States on Thursday imposed new sanctions against Iran, accusing it of interfering in the 2020 presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the new sanctions are the continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Saeed Khatibzadeh says that the U.S. has a long history of meddling in other countries' affairs and is playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Now, as a new round of talks with the P4+1 group is scheduled to start at the end of this month, U.S. measures are indicative of the fact that it is not sincere about Washington's return to the JCPOA, regardless of the fact which party is in the Oval Office.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on six Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American people.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Democratic Party repeatedly criticized Donald Trump during his term for his way of dealing with Iran and withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement. But ironically, since he came to power, Biden persisted in his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and even imposed more sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This is why U.S. media and officials have admitted that the campaign against Iran has failed. Tehran held several rounds of talks with the FIPOR Plus One group between April and June with the aim of removing the sanctions, but no breakthrough was reached. Now, as the new round of talks scheduled to start on November 29th draws nearer, the U.S. measures against Iran further question Washington's sincerity about the issue, regardless of which party is at the helm in the White House.
Well, joining us on this edition of Spotlight, we have activist from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco. And also we have journalist and author Daniel Azar joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Becker in San Francisco. Mr. Becker, Iran has condemned the latest U.S. sanctions, saying that the bans are the continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous administration, meaning the Donald Trump administration. Is that what's going on here, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. The basis given for the latest sanctions is just ludicrous. The idea that Iran was intimidating voters in the United States, that's the first time I heard that one. That's really creative on the part of those in the State Department and the National Security Council to come up with things like this. I mean, the whole representation of reality that is presented here is that Iran is threatening the United States. And Iran poses an ongoing danger to the United States. But it's not Iran, Iranian aircraft carriers and submarines sitting off the coast of New York or San Francisco, the way that the U.S. military is deployed, and particularly naval and air power is deployed surrounding Iran. And so we really have, and this I say this because this is the misrepresentation to the people of the United States that somehow Iran poses a grave danger, or Venezuela does, or Cuba does, or China does. And all of this is presented to the people here in order to justify this vast military network, the U.S. military network around the world. But again, as we said in the lead, we see the Biden administration essentially carrying out the maximum pressure campaign, which really has the effect of doing the greatest damage to the most vulnerable members of society. This is always who these kind of sanctions really impact, and that's the poor people, the working people, the farmers, the people who are deprived of the necessities of life, and at the same time, the intention is to weaken the country as a whole.
Daniel Azar, Washington accused those targeted by the sanctions of trying to influence America's 2020 presidential election. A guest that we spoke to actually here earlier on Press TV said that accusation appears to be part of efforts to brand Iran as a threat to America. How do you feel about these accusations?
Well, I mean, in this particular incident, I mean, we should be completely skeptical. I mean, the U.S. concept, understanding of what foreign interference means. It was the charges that made against Russia in 2016 were ludicrous. A Russian company had had, you know, placed $44,000 worth of ads on Facebook, some of which seemed to be anti-Hillary Clinton and pro-Donald Trump, and the U.S. authorities built that very minor incident with no proven relationship to the Russian government itself into a giant cause celebre that dominated American news for 3 years. So we've got to be maximally skeptical of these charges. But that said, I mean, the U.S. thinks nothing of doing the same thing to other countries, of using social media, various kinds of monetary investments, et cetera, in order to foment subversive movements in countries it doesn't like, such as Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, et cetera. So it has no compunctions about engaging in these activities itself. So when Iran engages in what, at the very most, is a minor intervention in the U.S., and I'm giving the U.S. too much credit and even describing it that way, we've just got to take it all with a huge grain of salt. And the U.S., the U.S. has stepped up pressure on Iran. Joe Biden's policies are indistinguishable from those of Donald Trump. In fact, if anything, they're even more aggressive. And the U.S. is obviously conducting a siege on Iran, which I think at some point could lead to a military confrontation.
Richard Becker, analysts say so far that this is the reaction that we've been seeing, that there's no evidence yet of any interference by Iran in the U.S. 2020 election. What does Iran actually have to gain from swaying the U.S. elections? Democrat or Republican, Washington has always maintained this enmity towards Iran since the inception of the Islamic Revolution. This makes these accusations even more questionable.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, no one that I know of before this has, hinted that there was some interference by Iran in the U.S. election. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. It's just such a ridiculous charge. And, I think really what the Security Council, National Security Council, or the State Department, or whoever is working, whose desks are assigned to this, to the Iran job, are doing, is that they find something and they say, this ad may have come from Russia or may have come from Iran, as if it's the government doing it. I mean, most of that stuff, I think, has been quite convincingly in the case of Russia, because this is the first time we've heard about the allegations regarding Iran. But the ones coming from Russia was that there were people who were playing both sides of the fence in some cases, and the interpretation given by the government here was, they're trying to confuse people. I mean, there's already enough polarization in society that don't need the Iranians or the Russians to prompt more polarization. But it was probably really fundraising. It's probably really like this kind of low-level fundraising, but it gets fit into what the outlook is at the governmental level, at the highest level, and wanting to step up the hostility toward Iran, wanting to impose new penalties, new punishments on Iran, and they're doing the same thing in regard to Cuba, where Trump put in 243 new sanctions policies. Biden has continued them all. So we have this continuation, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans in the White House, of this policy of maximum pressure, seeking to bring about regime change in countries that pose no threat to the United States, but simply wish to go their own way in the world. In other words, to use their own resources for the benefit of their own people and not be subject to the dictates and the whims of Washington.
Daniel Zahn, let's talk about the timing of these sanctions. As we know, the Vienna talks are set to restart in about 10 days, despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. U.S. is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle any of these disagreements. What is Washington trying to achieve with this type of behavior?
I think it's trying to ingratiate itself with Israel. I think it's trying to reassure Saudi Arabia that it's on its side. and I think it's trying to reestablish its credibility in the Persian Gulf following the chaotic Afghan retreat in August. So I think the U.S. is trying to puff itself up, to show it's still in control, to show it's still a tough guy, that it can push Iran around as much as it sees fit. But these policies, I think, just really just serve to, and they're so ridiculous, and U.S. credibility is so thoroughly shot that they sort of just wind up underscoring America's growing helplessness in this part of the world.
Richard Becker, we were talking about the timing. Tehran says that its goal of participating in the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal is not about the nuclear deal, actually, but about removal of anti-Iran sanctions. That does seem like a fair assessment, given that the nuclear deal has already been negotiated. What do you think about Tehran's stance in this regard?
Well, I think that anyone who looks at it from a common sense, logical point of view, as is often said, would have to agree with Iran and Iran's position on this. They negotiated a deal. It was a long, difficult process. Those negotiations were carried out leading up to the 2015 agreement with the sword hanging over Iran's neck of sanctions. The sanctions were already imposed. It was only to get rid of the sanctions, to get the sanctions lifted, that Iran agreed to enter into talks with countries, you know, a number of countries that had nuclear weapons and were insisting, no, Iran can't develop even peaceful nuclear development, as Iran said it was doing. So it was a very unjust, it was a very onerous process that went on. And then an agreement was reached. But as soon as the agreement was reached, the partners in the agreement, and by that I mean particularly the members of the European members of the Security Council and Germany, were going very slow because they were fearful that sanctions would be reimposed with a change in administration, and that they would be that would cause them problems. So they went very slow. Then Trump pulls out of the deal. And then those same partners appeal to Iran and say, no, no, don't pull out, stay in the deal. We will ameliorate the sanctions, the impact of the sanctions on you. And they didn't. They didn't do anything. It's a combination of fear of U.S. power, financial power in this case in particular, to levy enormous fines, and also that they have, ever since World War II, really been part of, and by far the junior partners, in the U.S. military alliance in the world.
Daniel Lazar, U.S. measures at this point, they're proving more and more that it's not sincere about the whole issue, regardless of, as we mentioned in our lead-in to the show, which person or party is in power in the White House. At this point, why should Iran even trust the U.S. altogether?
You know, it's really pretty remarkable. You know, the Biden, the Obama administration, which included Joe Biden, who was vice president at the time, negotiated this treaty. They were willing to buck pressure from Saudi Arabia and Israel. They took various measures to appease both nations, but at least they sort of showed a certain willingness to stand up to pressure from Riyadh and Jerusalem. But since then, but that was in 2015, and the 6 years since, the U.S. posture has weakened, so that the U.S. is unable to chart an independent policy vis-a-vis Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's actually more at the mercy of those two countries than it was before. So therefore, you know, Joe Biden, after taking part in negotiations in 2015, and then slamming Trump and withdrawing from the treaty unilaterally in 2018, now was unable to follow up by re-entering the treaty because it's afraid of what Israel will say, what Saudi Arabia will say, and what their allies on Capitol Hill will say. So all the U.S. does is like is show how weak and really helpless it is. And as to Iran, I mean, I agree. I think Iran must realize this point, that the U.S. really will never go re-enter that treaty under terms remotely acceptable to Tehran. So I think that that Iran is playing a waiting game. It has no reason to withdraw from the negotiations. So it's kind of playing things out and meanwhile trying to strike alliances with other countries, most notably China and Russia. So Iran is improving its position while I think the U.S. Is just showing greater and greater weakness.
Okay, one last question that I'm going to address to both of our guests tonight. Richard Becker, who benefits from this state of limbo, from this uncertainty regarding the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, I have to say, the U.S. is the center of the most far-flung empire that has ever existed. I don't think any constituent part of that empire, and Israel and Saudi Arabia, are both subordinate elements in it, that they control U.S. foreign policy. I don't think that's true, and I don't think that's logical. But it is, the U.S. empire is weakening. It's a weakening empire, and particularly in the Middle East, South Asia, you can see this. You have particularly because of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the way that it was carried out, but just the defeats that the U.S. has suffered in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And if you can't win, you lost, and that's the reality. So I think that they're trying to bolster their position in that part of the world, in the Middle East, while at the same time the U.S. is carrying out the pivot to Asia and preparations for war with China.
Same question to Daniel Azar before we wrap up the show. Who benefits from this limbo, this uncertainty regarding the JCPOA?
I'm not really sure if anybody benefits. I mean, I think what's happening is that both all sides are preparing for a greater conflict. I think that Israel has been threatening war against Iran for years, but I think the chances of a confrontation are going up. And I think if that happens, the U.S. will have no choice but to line up in support behind Israel. I think that someone once said that that peace is that moment of opportunity when everybody reloads their guns. So I think that all sides are preparing for some kind of further confrontation down the road.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Activists at the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco, and journalist and author Danny Lazar speaking to us from New York. Thank you for contributing to Spotlight. And also, I have to thank our guests for staying with us on show. It's a good night for now.